Hi, everyone. This is Deb from Dying to be Found. Before we get started, I just wanted to say that episodes may contain disturbing discussions on harmful acts and crimes against animals and or humankind. Listener discretion is strongly advised. I said we'd be back, and here we are. Thank you so much for hanging in with us. We did take a little hiatus to work on other amazing projects that I have already gotten out there on social media. Marianne, also known as the Social Detective, and I are partnering up to bring you a different kind of podcast where we advocate to create a much needed change in our criminal and social justice systems. Now, there are 6 brand new episodes out there waiting for you at Insinuation Podcast. Be sure to check that out wherever you find your podcasts at. I think you're really going to like it. In the meantime, Dying to be Found is entering our 3rd season where family members will still be dropping in, only we are going to bring you monthly episodes instead of weekly. And we appreciate everyone who has reached out to say, please do not stop with your episodes because we love Dying to be Found. And I appreciate that. So we heard you. We're listening. We're just going to be dropping once a month because I did discover the importance to work on my own self-care by spreading out my time. I do love you all too much to stop now. And today, my daughter Shelby is joining me here for our season 3 opener. Hi, Shelby. How are you?
Hello, I'm so good. I was just thinking while you were reading kind of the intro that we have not recorded since we were getting ready to go to Jody Messina. That was back in February.
Yeah. All right. You ready to get started? I know that people don't like small talk, so we're just going to get going here.
Yep, I'm ready.
I think that we could both say that as human beings, we do go through growing pains, mainly around those teenage years. Wouldn't you agree, Shelby?
Absolutely. I feel like teenagers on all sides of the teenage spectrum.
Yes. And they do say what goes around comes around tenfold.
Twice for me.
Well, I'm not going to lie. You tested me a little bit during your teenage years, and I'm glad that we can laugh about it now because I was thinking about this, Shelby, and as Forrest Gump says, life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. But in the end, I do feel like I have my best friend here with me today.
Aw, same.
Yeah. So how is teenage life going for you at home?
So far, I would say the last week has been pretty quiet.
Just the last week?
The last few months have been a complete roller coaster.
Yes, I know. And you never know when that's going to happen either, do you?
No.
Life is full of surprises. Well, today we are going to be talking about Lyle and Eric Menendez, 2 brothers living in California who, spoiler alert, Shelby, ended up killing both of their parents back in 1989.
I remember this.
How do you know this story?
Because I love true crime.
Oh, I got you. Okay. We're going to get into that act in just a little bit. But as I was researching this case, I was seeing a lot of articles dated just this year, Shelby. So there looks like there's new movement in this case, which leads me to believe that the Menendez brothers may be released from prison sooner rather than later.
Really?
Yeah. Have you not seen anything in the news?
I have not.
I think because I was researching, I came across those articles and I was very surprised because I know what they did. I know they should be serving out the rest of their life in prison, but we don't know that for sure. And I will go back to the beginning right now, but we'll get into that a little bit later. Joseph Lyle Menendez was born on January 10th, 1968 to Jose and Mary Louise, also known as Kitty, whom I will reference for the rest of this episode. And Eric Galen Menendez was born 2 years later on November 27th, 1970. The two boys came from a very affluent background. Their grandfather played for a professional soccer team in Cuba, and their mother was a swimmer who was elected to Cuba's Hall of Fame. I thought that was really interesting.
That is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I knew they were wealthy. I didn't know how, though.
Yeah, exactly. Me too. Well, their son, Jose Menendez, which is Lyle and Eric's father, eventually migrated to the United States when he was 16 years old during the Cuban Revolution. Oh, that's close to the age that I migrated to the United States. Huh. Jose followed in his parents' footsteps by earning a swimming scholarship during college in the United States, where he met his beauty queen, future wife, Mary Louise Kitty Anderson. Jose eventually went out to work as a CPA before getting into the music industry, where he became the head of RCA Records. During his tenure with RCA Records, he did give a few bands their start, and you may have heard of them, Shelby. More so 80s music, and that was my era, Duran Duran, and the Eurythmics. These are two of my favorite bands, and I don't know if you've heard of this one. It's a Puerto Rican band, Menudo. Have you heard of them?
No, I have not. I don't think I've heard of the Eurythmics either. I know Duran Duran.
Okay. Well, Menudo, I believe, had Ricky Martin in the band. Like, it was like a boy band of its time. Oh. So, yeah, I think that's where he got his start. This band will come up briefly a little bit later in the episode. But for now, as Jose continued to climb the corporate ladder, he eventually moved his family from New Jersey to Los Angeles, where he worked in the entertainment industry, in music, and as a film executive. So he's just really expanding his reach here, which is cool. By 1988, Jose's net worth was $14 million. That's back in 1988. So you know that's a ton of cash today.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And his family could certainly afford the luxurious lifestyle of the rich and famous. Jose purchased a family home in Beverly Hills, living amongst some of the most elite artists like Michael Jackson and Elton John. Could you imagine having Michael Jackson or Elton John in your neighborhood?
I could not.
That is pretty cool. Because here in the Atlanta area, it's not uncommon for people to have Atlanta Braves living in your neighborhood or Atlanta Falcons.
Well, I'm nowhere near the big city, so I don't think there's probably anybody famous that lives within a 100-mile radius of me.
Probably not, but I think that there was a famous baseball player that started out in one of your towns nearby.
Catfish Hunter.
Yeah, Catfish Hunter. All right, well, let's talk about Jose's personality for a moment. I think it's important to set the scene here based on later court testimonies. Jose was known to be a bit of a jerk around town. I mean, a lot of people work their way to the top through sheer ruthlessness. I think in the corporate world, that's pretty much how you do it. You step on people on the way up, right?
Oh, for sure.
Although Jose was very intelligent and business savvy, his coworkers, on the whole, disliked him.
Ah.
I know. I mean, I'm sure you've worked with people that you didn't like. I know I have.
I certainly have.
It's difficult.
Yeah, I hope that nobody would ever look at me and think that. I always try to be very respectful. I do have my days. Yesterday was one of them. Oh.
I think there's a difference, though, of being diplomatic in your approach to communication versus just being a jerk. You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
So the general consensus was that Jose did come across as rude, arrogant, and pretty abrasive during his interactions with others. And this didn't just happen in the workplace. Jose was also known to be very stern with his two boys, Lyle and Eric, while they were growing up.
I was just thinking before you went to this paragraph that I bet that rude, arrogant, abrasive, you know, behavior was definitely coming home too.
Oh yeah, it's ingrained in the personality, I think. You're not going to change from one personality to the next just because you're in work versus home environments. Unfortunately for Kitty, he had lots of extramarital affairs and didn't really treat Kitty much differently from their children. I did find a few articles where he was abusive towards her, but more so towards the boys. As the Menendez brothers grew up, Lyle began playing tennis and did pretty well. He was naturally ranked in his age group. And I'm thinking about this, Shelby, because you play travel softball, so, you know, you have those age groups that you're in. And he seemed to be following in Jose's footsteps as a successful businessman as well, because, you know, he's older, he's in his 20s. So he's beginning to find his way in life. Mm-hmm. I don't think Lyle was doing this on his own, though. Due to his competitive nature, Jose worked Lyle very hard at tennis practice. So there's a little bit of a difference between Lyle and Eric, because Eric was a swimmer. He's following in his mother's footsteps. One of Eric's swimming coaches had told a reporter at some point in time that Jose was one of those overbearing parents on the sidelines who interfered with Eric's performance, which really damaged Eric's self-confidence. Oh, goodness. Now, that's tough, Shelby, and here's why. I just mentioned that you played travel softball. I mean, me personally, I stayed away from parents like that. I saw them out on the field, and some of the kids that you played with had a hard time meeting the expectations of their very own parents, and that is why I kept books. I just needed to stay away from all that. Grown-ups are terrible about the drama.
Exactly. Oh my gosh, just these, you know, high school soccer games. I remember one game in particular, Ian's senior year, and it was, you know, these parents are cussing on the sidelines, and some of these kids on the field are 15 years old, you know, they're ninth graders. It's so sad. I mean, I can only imagine if they're not, you know, meeting performance expectations during the event, what are those kids having to hear on the way home? And that's just not right.
Yeah, I don't think I ever did that to you. I think it's just like, you know, you're talented, you go do your thing. You know, I was very proud of you. But if you had a bad day, you had a bad day.
Oh, yeah. Everybody's entitled to that.
Yep.
Nobody's perfect.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and skip ahead to August 18th, 1989. When Lyle, age 21 at the time, and Eric, age 18, took a road trip to San Diego and stopped at a local sporting goods store to make a purchase. Two grown adults just going for a ride, Shelby. And I do want to kind of emphasize that both of them are considered adults, even though Eric just turned 18. He's, in my mind, still a teenager. Really doesn't have that maturity level with him yet. But then Lyle is 21. I mean, he's still getting there, but has a few years on Eric. And I wanted to give you a little bit of a perspective on this drive. The distance between Los Angeles, where they lived, and San Diego was about 120 miles or 193 kilometers, which took about 2 hours to travel. I mean, honestly, that's nothing because you live in the car. I live in the car. We love our road trips, right?
Yes, we do. That's about the mileage I had to drive last weekend to go get my kid.
Well, this wasn't just any old road trip. The two men, and I say men because they had gone on a mission to purchase some 12-gauge shotguns that they would use 2 days later to pump 15 rounds into their parents as they sat watching television. And I mean, Jose and Kitty were watching television. The brothers didn't purchase handguns, Shelby. They purchased rifles that are known for home defense and also for hunting large game birds or military defense. Those are the kind of weapons that these two men purchased on a 2-hour road trip.
They had the intent to kill. There was no maybe they'll make it through it.
Oh, yeah. Totally premeditated. Well, one day after those shotguns were purchased, Jose and Kitty took Lyle and Eric out on a yachting excursion for the day. Just one day. And then one day later after that, Shelby, the brothers executed both parents as they were in the living room watching a television show winding down for the day. That's horrific.
It is. They never saw it coming.
Nope. Now, immediately following this ambush, the Menendez brothers changed into clean clothes. They went to a local movie theater to purchase Batman tickets. They dumped the guns that they had just used to kill their parents and headed back home only to, air quote, discover their parents had been murdered.
Wow.
Now, Lyle was the one to call 911. Saying that someone had killed their parents while he and Eric were out for the night. So here the investigation begins. Of course, the brothers are going to be questioned on their whereabouts during the evening. They devised their story so well of going out to the movie theater that nobody really questioned it. And I do kind of want to point out to Shelby that this was 1989, well before closed circuit television and the true crime explosion where everybody's watching. You know, things were a little bit simpler back then, and taking their word for it, I think, was a big factor as well.
Mm-hmm.
When police first arrived on scene, they found Eric sobbing on the front lawn of his parents' home when responding to that 911 call. Of course, these two very clean-cut, wealthy boys could have nothing to do with this, right?
Good acting.
For sure. Now, although there was no sign of forced entry, neither Lyle nor Eric were on the investigators' radar. I had just mentioned it was a simpler time, simpler life. These kids are coming from a wealthy background. They were never even tested for gunshot residue. Besides going to the movies, Lyle and Eric also threw in that they had to backtrack to pick up Eric's ID. I guess they wanted that little bit of cushion as far as timing.
Mm-hmm.
They had said that he had left that behind before heading back and making their discovery. Investigators either believed the brothers and simply did not follow up, or they just didn't follow up with any of the movie theater employees to corroborate this story, because I found that a little odd that the police would not go and interview any of the employees to verify that Eric and Lyle had showed back up to get an ID, because they would have had something behind the counter in the lost and found. Police just didn't follow up on this.
Yeah, that's a hard spot for them to be in. I mean, when you have two wealthy parents that just parents in general that have just died in that kind of manner, and then the last thing that I would think is that it'd be their kids.
Oh, yes.
But I guess that's why when you're a law enforcement, you have to put those feelings aside.
Well, we do know that based on Eric's demeanor immediately following his parents' murder, plus during the police interviews, that he was just straight up a mess. And this was Eric. Lyle, on the other hand, was calm, cool, and collected throughout the entire investigation, and even suggested at some point that he believed that it could have been a mob hit. Of course, he made that suggestion, Shelby, about the mob, because he had just killed his parents, and you could not act your way out of this one.
No, that'd be really hard. It seems like Eric, though, you know, they had so much adrenaline leading up to the moment and during the moment of that happening, and it's probably just set in with him, like, oh my gosh, like, they are gone. They're not coming back.
Yeah, and I don't know the dynamics of the brothers' relationship. I mean, typically siblings are very close, but clearly Lyle is the leader here, mm-hmm. because he was the one that was following in his dad's footsteps as far as a businessman. Eric was still on the young side, and I would consider to be just a little bit of a follower. But Lyle and Eric continued to stick to their story over the next 6 months, that of being at the movies when their parents were murdered. But here are where things get a little bit strange. And you can say that Lyle and Eric's behavior became a little bizarre in that six-month period, Shelby. On the day of Jose and Kitty's funeral, Lyle showed off some shoes that he was wearing during his limo ride. He happened to be sharing this limo with Jose's secretary and a few others, and thought it would be great to break the ice and engage in some small talk. During the limo ride, Lyle pointed at the loafers that he had taken from his own father's closet to wear at the funeral, and nonchalantly asked his fellow passengers, quote, "Who said I couldn't fill my father's shoes?" Unquote. Lyle then went on to wonder aloud how he could get tickets to the U.S. Open, which was scheduled to take place August 28th through September 10th, 1989, just 3 days after Jose and Kitty's funeral. In case you don't know what the U.S. Open is, it's a big tennis tournament. And going from here, Shelby, things just became a little sus, because as Lyle and Eric continued to live the high life for the next 6 months, they did go on living their best life after killing their parents like nothing ever happened. Because just 6 days after their parents' death, Lyle decided to go on a shopping spree that would clearly cheer him up. I mean, what better thing to do besides go to the U.S. Open, go do some shopping?
I'm curious, because, you know, I see this a lot at work when you have a lot of money, you have financial advisors involved and, you know, there's trust set up and all of that kind of stuff. So did they, and maybe you'll get to this, but are they stealing the credit cards from the parents? Do they have an allowance? I'm just wondering where they're getting this money from.
I did not see one article that said that they have a trustee. So I'm going to assume they were using credit cards, but I'm not there. I don't know specifically. It was just very clear that they were going on shopping sprees because they came up with some pretty good merchandise. They paid over $15,000 for not one, but three Rolex watches.
I have a lot of other things in mind that I could spend $15,000 on, and it does not involve three watches.
No, it sure doesn't. That doesn't even buy a car these days, but back then it was a pretty big chunk. They could buy the watches and they probably didn't think twice about it because the money was running fluidly, I think, through the house. Now, Lyle and Eric moved out of their $3.5 million home. And that's about $7.5 million today, Shelby, and went to stay in expensive hotels before leasing a condominium where they had adjoining apartments to make sure that they always had enough room to party. And I'd ask why they didn't just stay in their LA home, but it was probably still taped off. They could have been giving off the persona that they did not want to stay there with the trauma that they endured. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of reasons why they did not just stay in the family home.
Yeah, if I had offed someone like that, I wouldn't want to stay there either. Not that I would ever do that.
Well, like Lyle, Eric also enjoyed his Rolexes, but he also liked to gamble. Eric hired a tennis coach to hopefully help him get good enough to go pro. But remember, Shelby, Eric is 18 years old and he was the swimmer between the two brothers. To me, he started a little bit too late to go pro in tennis, but he did fly to the Middle East to compete in some tournaments. In all, Lyle and Eric spent a minimum of $1 million from their parents' estate in about 6 months while going on all those shopping sprees and various excursions. Eric had decided not to attend UCLA, where he was scheduled to attend in the fall. He opted for those professional tennis lessons, which, by the way, cost $60,000. He invested in a rock concert that never happened and bought himself a Jeep Wrangler. Lyle returned to Princeton University in New Jersey, but it was just for show, Shelby. He continued on with more shopping sprees, which consisted of buying clothes, a Porsche, and a restaurant that he had hoped would eventually turn into a franchise under his newly formed LLC called Menendez Investment Enterprises. That's a great name. And if he's business savvy, aside from the fact of what he's dealing with and what he's hiding behind, he had some good ventures there.
Oh, yeah. Especially, you know, at a younger age.
Mm-hmm. For good measure, Lyle and Eric made one more investment. They both began therapy with Dr. Jerome Oziel to help get themselves through their parents' death. Dr. Oziel was already known to Eric because a year earlier, he had burglarized some homes in Los Angeles and was court-ordered to attend therapy in order to avoid jail time. Okay, you see what money can buy here? It gets you out of jail free. Just go to a therapy session or two.
Right. And you're free.
Yeah. Not just anybody is going to be given that option. I'm going to say if they burglarized a home, they're going to go to jail at least for a year, do some community service, but nope, not the Menendez brothers. Now, we know that all good things eventually come to an end. And during all of this shopping, partying, and shaking Jose and Kitty's money tree, Eric was really beginning to unravel internally. He was the one on the front lawn, visibly upset when the police came that night. And cracks from the pressure of what he and Lyle had done were beginning to form. Eric ultimately developed an ulcer from all the stress of keeping their dirty little secret. I get it. Some people just can't handle the pressure, especially at this level of secrecy. But yeah, he was becoming physically sick over all of this, and I can understand why. During one of his therapy sessions with Dr. Oziel, Eric spilled it all and confessed everything.
Wow.
Now, we do know that there is doctor-client privileges, and typically a therapist is not obligated to report what was said during a patient's therapy session.
I think this is an exception, though.
Yeah, you would think, but Eric probably felt safe in doing so in that space because he was probably aware of those privileges. And Dr. Oziel did hold up his end of the bargain, at least as far as reporting the Menendez brothers to the authorities. He didn't do it. It was his mistress, whom he had confided in, who reported Lyle and Eric to the police. Dr. Oziel had let her listen to one of Lyle and Eric's taped therapy sessions.
Wow.
I know, right? Can you imagine? Oh my goodness, I have the juiciest gossip. You're just not going to believe this. Listen to what I recorded. Could you imagine somebody coming to you and letting you listen to something like that and then swear to secrecy not to tell?
Right. No.
All right, well, don't think that his mistress was doing anything right here, because apparently she and her lover had a somewhat tumultuous relationship, and immediately following an alleged attack by the good doctor, she took her copies. Yes, I said copies. She had copies of this tape. She took the copies of Eric and Lyle's tape confessions from that therapy session straight to the police.
How in the world did she get copies?
I mean, if she's at home and he's at work, I'm sure that she did a little digging, snooping around, got the little tape recorder out. Easy to do when you had cassette tape shelves. You wouldn't understand.
I know what that is. I watched the Long Island Medium. She uses those.
Oh, wow. On March 8th, 1990, 203 days after Jose and Kitty's murder, Lyle Menendez was arrested. Authorities could not yet arrest Eric in the same day because he was currently in Israel playing a tennis match. News did reach him, however, that Lyle had been arrested, and Eric flew home voluntarily, where he too was arrested for the murders of his parents on March 11th, 1990. So, 3 days after Lyle. Even though the Menendez brothers were arrested for what we call as parricide, that's another word for the murder of one's parents, the case stalled for several years. Lyle and Eric would later be tried at the same time, but they did have separate trials so that they each had their own jury. The judge overseeing this case originally ruled that portions from both Lyle's and Eric's taped therapy sessions would be admissible in court after Eric was heard threatening Dr. Oziel's life during one of his taped therapy sessions. This, in turn, broke the doctor-patient confidentiality.
Oh my God.
I know, right? Well, defense lawyers appealed this ruling, and the case dragged on for another 30 months until the Supreme Court weighed in and said, get on with it. These men are entitled to a speedy trial. I get it. I mean, that is one of the things that's supposedly great about the United States, is that you are entitled to a speedy trial. But you hear about so many people remaining behind bars for years before that trial gets started.
Mm-hmm.
Define speedy, will you?
Right.
Two of the three therapy sessions were ruled admissible as evidence, one of which contained Lyle's own words saying what he had done. Eric was also heard on these tapes that although he fired first, Lyle fired best. On December 7th, 1992, the Menendez brothers' trial began. The news media went into a frenzy, and Court TV had round-the-clock coverage of the trial, plus additional commentaries before and after each day's testimonies. And Shelby, this is really where the door opened up to true crime drama, because Court TV made a name for itself during this trial, which had come just before the infamous O.J. Simpson trial back in 1994.
I could see that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember it was all over. Everything was live, and I'd be running home and turning on the TV and seeing what I could pick up since I had just worked 8 hours, and it was a constant at this point in time. The sensationalism of this trial was pretty crazy, Both parents were murdered by two handsome, young, rich, white men dressed in pastel sweaters during their trial. And that was a big talking point, too. The news media was all over how the Menendez brothers dressed for their trials.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Some of the key talking points during their trial are as follows. Defense attorney Leslie Abramson set the stage with the story of both brothers enduring years of verbal and sexual abuse from a highly controlling father. Now, up until this point, Shelby, not one word of sexual abuse. But when the trial began, their lawyer really argued that point. Lyle testified that he had been molested by his father between the ages of 6 and 8. Eric testified that he was molested as well, beginning at the age of 8, but continuously through the age of 18. Therefore, Lyle and Eric killed both parents in self-defense.
I don't think it was self-defense.
Yeah, I'm sure there are legalities involved with that statement right there, because I didn't see anything where the boys were being physically attacked when they committed the murders. I'm not really sure, but I'm just thinking Kitty got in the middle of this.
I think the mom was stuck in the middle, too.
I really do. I mean, you can only do so much to protect your children from an angry father who had that personality type that I had described. I'm sure that he didn't like it too much if she got involved.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Abramson also painted Kitty as an alcoholic and drug addict who was devastated by her ever-cheating husband. Remember, Shelby, he didn't really hide his extramarital affairs from his wife. It was a constant in their relationship, so she just dealt with that openly the best that she could. Abramson also went on to argue that Lyle and Eric simply could not take it anymore, and they had decided just weeks before the murders that they were going to confront Jose with their allegations of abuse. But when it was all said and done, Eric's jury deadlocked on a verdict on January 10th, 1994. Lyle's jury deadlocked 2 weeks later. Both cases were declared a mistrial, and prosecutors and the defense had to start all over again.
Wow, this has gone on forever.
It really did go on a very long time, and I almost think this is probably why you remember it, because it took 7 years to find Lyle and Eric Menendez guilty of murdering their parents. So this would have been on the news when you were growing up. Now, it did take that 7 years because during their first trial, both Lyle and Eric's lawyers painted that rather disturbing picture of the boys' upbringing in the Menendez household. Now, remember that I had told you about Jose's personality, how his co-workers perceived him to be somewhat of a jerk? The brothers stated that they were going to confront Jose with the sexual assault allegations with the intentions of making this go public if Jose did not stop. So it sounds to me like they were planning to blackmail him, maybe?
That's what it sounds like.
Just let me repeat this. I had mentioned this at the beginning of this episode. Lyle was 21. Eric was 18. So I'm a little bit surprised. I'm not going to say that it was an easy decision, but why are they waiting until now to confront Jose here? I'm sure there's a lot of reasons why they were waiting. And things can build up. You can only take so much.
Right. Well, with Lyle being 21, it makes me wonder if there was a little alcohol encouragement.
Yeah, never thought of that. Well, for good measure, don't forget, Lyle and Eric had taken that road trip down to San Diego, a 4-hour round trip from Los Angeles, to purchase those shotguns in fear of retaliation from Jose. You know, because he was a jerk. That, to me, I thought was a little strange as well, for the fact that they went ahead and made that trip because they were already thinking Jose was going to retaliate.
I mean, when you're being accused of doing something like that, Jose was probably going to blow up pretty big.
Oh, yeah. Well, the brothers did what they did, and their first trial was televised for the world to see. The general public didn't like the defense's argument about the Menendez brothers being sexually abused, and neither did the prosecutors. Now, here's why. Lyle and Eric went on that $1 million spending spree and partied it up for 6 months. after they had just killed their parents. The brothers were perceived to be whining on the stand while giving their testimony. Their temperaments did not come across as showing real emotion. So a lot of people felt that they were just acting the whole time, which gave the general public and most likely the jury members the impression that things simply were not adding up here. And besides that, Shelby, not one therapist, friend, or family member got on the stand to corroborate the brothers' allegations of sexual abuse by their father. Now, I once again never will discount that this type of abuse occurs, Shelby. If this was Lyle and Eric's truth, I'm not here to judge it. Child molestation is despicable and no one should ever get away with that. Unfortunately, Lyle and Eric didn't just come across as believable when they went on the stand to testify. You know how people look upset and even act like they're crying, but you never see those tears? That's how they came across on the stand. That was the public's image. Now, the public really wasn't having any of it, and in October 1993, while the trial was still going on, John Malkovich, you know him, right?
No, I don't.
Famous actor? Oh, you've never heard of John Malkovich? Okay, no. You can go look him up, but he is a famous actor. You know how actors typically go on Saturday Night Live? Well, he played Lyle Menendez on Saturday Night Live, speaking in a very flat voice and fake crying, and the live audience absolutely loved it. I think there's a lot of misconceptions there too. I mean, if we're going to talk about insinuations like my insinuation podcast, I mean, that's the whole thing, is there's so many insinuations here and people are jumping to conclusions. You just have to get all the facts before you should do that. So going into both cases, Shelby, we know that there was a declared mistrial. The second trial took place in 1995, only this time the judge overseeing the trial refused to allow TV cameras in the courtroom for any of this second go-round, because we saw what a circus it was the first go-round. The judge, I think, used a little bit of discretion that second time. He felt there was too much publicity from that first trial, which could have been one of the reasons why the juries resulted in deadlock. I kind of agree with that because it really was quite a circus.
Yeah, I think he made a smart decision.
He also ruled that there was insufficient evidence of any alleged abuse by Jose against his boys, nor the possibility that Lyle and Eric had killed in self-defense out of fear. Okay, so you know what? I mean, I kind of wonder this too. Did he get some of his own predispositions because of what he saw on this televised court case before he became the judge in the second trial? I kind of wondered that.
That's possible.
Now, remember how I told you the band Menudo would come out into play here?
Yes.
Well, one of the band members eventually came forward years later to say that he, too, had been sexually abused by Jose Menendez. So this is now opening the Menendez brothers' original allegations into question. So the judge is saying, I'm not really sure there's enough evidence, but a famous band member comes forward to say, hey, this happened to me too. So I guess my question is why did he not come forward sooner during the first trial? We'll never know. And again, that's his truth, and you can't ever really judge anybody as to why they're not going to say anything. I was just curious as to why he waited until the second trial. 7 years and two trials later, Lyle and Eric Menendez were both found guilty of murdering their parents, and both were convicted of two counts of first-degree murder. Lyle and Eric were sentenced to two consecutive life terms in prison without the possibility of parole. California's like that, man. If you get sentenced for life, you will live and die in prison.
Wow. Gosh, they were so young.
I know, they really were. Because we're going to jump ahead to today's day and age. Lyle is currently 55. Eric is 52. They are now both housed in the same correctional facility in San Diego. Initially, Shelby, when they first went off to prison, they were sent to separate prisons, but they were reunited in 2018. Both Lyle and Eric work on campus on beautification projects, plus counsel inmates who were sexually abused.
Wow.
I mean, they're doing good things behind bars.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, and Lyle went on to get credentials in sociology, so he has earned a bachelor's degree while behind bars, which, Shelby, I actually do love when I hear that inmates do go on to get a degree because they are rehabilitating, and it does sound like he is trying to be proactive in his own ways.
Oh, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Lyle and Eric eventually married. Lyle married a former model, but soon divorced when he began to have another relationship with a different woman, whom he eventually married in 2003 and is still married to today.
Wow.
And there's always somebody that's going to contact an inmate.
Mm-hmm.
Eric married a pen pal in 1999 and is still married as well.
Wow.
I mean, are you happy for them?
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like they're doing good things.
Okay.
I don't know. They're put in such a hard situation, I think. And I think that they're just trying to make the best of it.
I think so, too. Yeah, I mean, they are definitely being proactive. But don't think we're done, because here comes the twist. Remember, Shelby, at the very beginning of this episode, when I told you that there were a ton of new articles on the Menendez brothers case, as in this year?
Yes.
Lyle had told Rosie O'Donnell in a September 2023 interview that if he ever gets out of prison, he will continue on with his life's work to help rehabilitate inmates who are victims of sexual abuse. In March 2024, Newsweek reported that Fox Nation was streaming a four-part series about this case. Lyle is quoted in numerous recent articles saying that he and Eric should have received an 8 to 10 year conviction for manslaughter at best, but wound up receiving a sentence comparable to a serial killer. He's not wrong, but I'm kind of sensing a little bit of entitlement here after 35 years. What are your thoughts to that?
I'm curious as to not what he has to say, but if that's actually true, because I mean, they were so young, and I don't know the stipulations really between first, second degree murder versus manslaughter. But to me, I think two consecutive life sentences, like, I mean, what they did was very, very serious, but I do think that it was a little harsh for coming, just considering what they went through as children, how other people perceived how, you know, Jose was treating them. I think it was harsh. Definitely guilty.
Yeah, definitely. And it was a cut and dry case, but there's so many different elements and factors involved, like how the sexual abuse came up later during the trial that was never mentioned before. But then you're dealing with these young men who just lost their parents, but they're out partying. So you just have to go with the facts.
Right.
Now, let me tell you, in my opinion, just from everything that I've read, Lyle Menendez seems to be the spokesperson these days because, Shelby, you're not going to believe this. You and I talked about going to CrimeCon in Nashville this year.
We did.
We didn't make it, but guess who did?
Lyle.
Lyle.
Oh.
Lyle participated in a telephone interview at CrimeCon in Nashville, Tennessee, which I did actually go look up and listen to it for a few minutes. And I mean, he's a very well-versed man. Again, I think that there's a lot of information coming out right now because the brothers have been trying to prove that the abuse from their father really did happen. And again, if this is their truth, it needs to be validated. But here are some arguments that I believe, Shelby, Lyle and Eric do deserve to have their cases revisited. Number one, I had mentioned the Menudo band member who came forward with those allegations that Jose had also abused him. So that's new evidence that was never presented at trial number one. Eric Menendez wrote a letter to his cousin back in 1988, a year before these murders occurred, which happened to resurface in 2018 and corroborates the fact that the brothers had been sexually abused. He had written a letter to his cousin to say, hey, this is going on. The letter lay tucked in a drawer somewhere until 2018 when it was discovered. I believe Eric's cousin is deceased at this point in time, so when his family members were going through his things, I believe that's when they found it. Now, both Lyle and Eric have always maintained that they killed their parents through self-defense after suffering from their abuse and PTSD.
Wow.
Shelby, did I mention PTSD one time during this episode?
No.
Yeah. So Psychology Today references numerous legal cases that can potentially back up the Menendez brothers' claims of parental abuse. New Jersey State versus Kelly in 1984 refers to a case where a woman's murder conviction was overturned on appeal after it was determined that she had suffered from battered spouse syndrome. Rogers versus Florida State in 1993 states that PTSD should have been considered during the Menendez brothers' trials. Not once was that brought up in court. And I don't know if you could even reference cases that took place after a murder trial, which the Menendez brothers' trials occurred in 1989, but I don't know if you can use these on appeal years later. I suppose you could, because hindsight being the fact that PTSD was never introduced into the boys' trials. But there's another case, New Jersey State versus Hines in 1997, also referenced how an expert was never asked to testify on the effects of PTSD when a defendant was convicted of manslaughter after being abused by her father for years. So, similar to the Rogers versus Florida State, attorneys can come back later and argue that defense lawyers from 1989 were incompetent. Kind of agree with that, because they never had experts on the witness stands. They never referenced PTSD.
No, and I totally think that could be a factor.
I do too, which I believe is why this case is coming up back in the news. In May of 2024, Lyle and Eric's attorneys began making the argument that, based on Eric's letter to his cousin in 1988, both brothers were being unlawfully imprisoned. I mean, if they win, holy cow, Shelby, look out. There's going to be another lawsuit.
Oh, yes. That's what it sounds like.
There's currently something on Paramount Plus that's streaming called The Menendez Brothers Fight for Freedom. So if you want to know more about this case, absolutely go and watch that as we wait for the new judge's decision in 2024. I have not watched it. I do get Paramount Plus, so I do have this on my viewing list. I just haven't gotten to it yet.
Yeah, I'd be interested to watch it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess because, too, he was just at CrimeCon as well, pretty much talking about the same thing. I really find it fascinating that this case is coming back into the news headlines.
Yeah, me too. You know, I think they deserve a second chance at life, and I'm interested in watching the new streaming. I'm pretty sure a few years ago that's where I learned about this case was there was some kind of documentary on ID Channel, so it'd be interesting to kind of see it turn around a little bit.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that, in a nutshell, is the story of the Menendez brothers, one of the infamous cases that gave Court TV its name and opened the door to true crime podcasters like us. We would love to receive feedback on this storyline or any of our other episodes, so make sure you DM us on Instagram. So there you have it, Shelbs.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing the story with us today. Do you have a teachable moment?
I believe I do. Gosh, it's been a while since I've had a teachable moment here. I can't help but to think that this case never should have gotten as far as it did. Jose and Kitty's murders never should have happened. Children who are sexually abused are far more likely to experience emotional challenges later in life. Clearly that happened with the Menendez brothers. And traumas such as what Lyle and Eric allegedly endured do interfere with future relationships. Shelby, according to the Independent Inquiry Child Sexual Abuse Organization, sexual abuse is also linked with physical challenges such as hypertension, chronic fatigue, malnutrition, mobility, and problems with reproductive systems and childbirth. So there are lifelong challenges here. We just need to be mindful of all the warning signs, which can be a very long list of both psychological and physical. I just encourage our listeners to go look up the warning signs, then be mindful if any of these pop up amongst someone that you know. It could be a family member or even a child in the neighborhood. Don't be afraid to pick up the phone and report it to the authorities if you truly believe that someone is being sexually abused. It's better to have someone investigated and come up with unsubstantial findings rather than the other way around, which clearly happened here in the Menendez brothers case. And that's my teachable moment.
I think that's a good one.
Thanks. Well, thanks for listening to Dying to be Found, True Crime Podcast. Before we go, we would love for you to follow us on TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and Pinterest at Dying to be Found. If you have a storyline that you would like to hear, click on our Linktree account found in our show notes, where you can also find our social media, website address, and a little bit more. Don't forget to give us that 5-star review to help us out in the ratings. Talk to you soon.